serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Great to catch up today with Don Malik, one of our country's foremost test pilots. He flew higher and faster than most of us can even imagine. In some cases, he flew aircraft that had never been flown before, risking his life, of course, in that process. You can read about it in his book, The Smell of Kerosene, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You can also pull up our original interview with Don there, covering his childhood to his days as a Navy fighter pilot, and then that new frontier of experimental aviation. That full trajectory of his life is captured in the new documentary, Flight Path to NASA, A Pilot's Journey. You can watch the trailer for the film at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, for that matter. We'll hear more from the filmmaker, Cameron Mitchell, in a moment. But first, Don, I'm curious because I know you encounter young people from time to time, and a lot of them might want to follow in that flight path of yours and do some of the things that you had the opportunity to do. So you have any advice for them?
I do, and it's probably based on my experience and what I went through in preparing for it. I always encourage them to do well in school and apply themselves in school and not to get into the habit of just coasting through and doing the average to make it through, but do the best they can in school. Take all the courses that they can in the technical area and mathematics and science and things like that if they're planning to go into something like the test flying. And that's the biggest thing. I just sort of encourage them, and I said, don't worry about doing it all at once. It'll unfold in front of you, and there'll be one step you'll make, and the next time there'll be another step or Y in the road, and you'll select that, and you just keep building on it, and you'll wind up at your goals, what you're doing. But you have to work and concentrate on each area as you go through it. So I think mostly I encourage them on the school and the schoolwork. And I know myself, there were a few courses in school I wasn't that fired up about or interested in. And later on, when it came to some of the writings and putting things together and everything, I wish I'd have paid a little more mind to them. I was more interested in the chemistry and the science and the math than I was in some of the literature and the other things. But just encourage them to do well in their school.
Your birthday here in October, turning 90 years old. Let's say that Cameron's film has an outlet and it's going to be debuted, and like he mentioned, they're able to dust off the LLRV and bring it out there for you. Assuming it's operational, would you climb back in there and buckle up and lift that thing off?
Oh, yeah. You know, when we toured the LLRV with Yule and Cameron, Gene Matranga was a project manager, a real fine NASA gentleman that was on that LLRV, and Gene was with us out in front of the LLRV. I think Yule asked me that, and I told him, I said, I turned to Gene, I said, well, if Gene will get that computer, had about a 400-pound computer on the tail end of it that did all the brain work for the flight control system, I said, if Gene will get that computer up, I'll fly it. And Gene looked at me, he shook his head. He said, oh, he said, we'll never get that back up. It was interesting. When I flew that bird, we flew early in the morning, and we liked it because of cooler temperatures. We had more thrust and more lift and lower winds. And I would get a call in the morning from the project engineer. They'd go out there at 2 o'clock in the morning and roll it out and put power on it. And that computer had to run for several hours without a glitch, and they monitored it because it was primary for the flight control system. Well, then they'd call me around 5 o'clock or 5:30, and they'd wake me up, and they'd say, Don, we're looking good. We're looking good. We're going to fly. So I'd get dressed and go out, and we'd fly. If the computer went haywire or had some problems, they wouldn't call me. So then my regular alarm clock would wake me up about 6:30 or something, and I'd go up and go in. But the big thing is it takes so much preparation, and everything had to be just up to snuff to fly it. So, but as far as the physical thing and getting in and flying, so no problem. I tell you another short story here. When I retired in 87, we were retiring our F-104 support airplanes. We used the 104 for chase, for photo chase, and pilot proficiency. And we had one or two of them where we had little test vanes or programs on them, projects on the airplane themselves. but they were getting pretty old, and the Air Force had retired theirs years before. We were having trouble getting spare parts, so we requested some F-18s from the Navy to replace them. And NASA does that a long time. They don't have a lot of money to just buy a fleet. But if the military can support us or bail us airplanes, it works pretty good. But anyway, I went through the ground school up at Navy Lamar for the F-18. I was getting ready to fly it, and the ones that we were sent by the Navy were pretty bad shape. And our maintenance people went through them. They come up to operations. They said, gentlemen, we cannot bring these airplanes up to our safety flight level. They're worn out. Wow. So we sent back the Navy. We said, hey, where do you want us to put these junkers you gave us? We're not able to use them. And I think that embarrassed the Navy. But anyway, I retired soon after that. And in the meantime, the Navy came through a year or two later with some F-18s that the Blue Angels had flown for a couple of years. And then they upgraded to newer ones. But their F-18s were pretty nice shape, and they gave them to NASA, loaned them to NASA. And I've been retired 5 years, and I was at the center just for a visit. Said, do you want to fly the F-18? And I said, yeah. Well, they said the two places in maintenance would be ready in 2 weeks. So I grabbed the handbook, and I went back home. And the thing that impressed me was I started to review the handbook. And what impressed me after 5 years was what I remembered from the Navy school up at Lemoore. Of course, I always had the attitude in an airplane. The more you knew about the airplane and the systems before you get into flight, the more you enjoyed flying it. You weren't flying it looking at something and say, hey, what's going on? You knew what was going on. But anyway, I was impressed, and I remembered that 5 years. I went back, and I had a flight with them, and it was a great flight. And I thought, well, I don't know if I'd have done that. They invited me back after I was retired 5 years to do that. I was impressed with that and the airplane.
Love it.
There you go, Don, holding back the good stories that I didn't get on film.
Well, I guess I should ask you too, Don, because I asked Cameron what he hopes people learn from the film or what they take away from it. You've seen it. It's your life story. What do you hope people see, hear, experience, or take away when they spend the time to watch this?
When I made a couple of other TV programs, I did one on the B-70 with Fitz Fulton for the Great Plains program. It was impressive to me to know that it was projected, it was available. I think I thought more of my family and my contacts and people I knew were able to see more of the details, more of the things that I'd done, whereas before they just said, well, you're a pilot and that's great, but they got to see more of it. So that's my feeling. Yes, I'll be happy to see it projected and that people get an idea of that era that I went through and what happened and why it happened. That'll be satisfying to me, but probably more for family, more for relatives and cousins and people like that are familiar with you in general, and they get a better look-see. So that's a big thing. Just another 15 minutes of fame is what we used to call it out at work down there when they come out to do a movie or something about a project and they're taking pictures or you're doing an interview or something like that. But primarily just to get it documented, and I'm sure the grandchildren will appreciate it and enjoy it too. It'd be something for them to see and point out to their friends that, hey, that was Grandpap.
Yeah, and I know this seems like a cliched question or maybe even melodramatic, but I just imagine that as you watch the documentary, even as you thumb through the pages of your book, or if you're just sitting around the house and remembering, there've got to be times where you say, how did I live through all that? How did I, make it through all those situations? And guys just like you were killed doing the same kind of work. Does that ever make you marvel?
Well, it does. It does. I didn't talk about that too much in the book or anything, but when I went through Navy flight training one fall just before Christmas, I think November or so, down at Corpus Christi, Texas at Cabinets Field, we lost five cadets in about 3 weeks were killed. And we weren't that big an organization. We had about four training squadrons, and two of them were mid-airs where there were two airplanes lost in each crash. That was four pilots and one pilot. had monoxide poisoning, and he spun in. But that was a pretty big shock, even in flight training when you're young and you're thriving and you're working hard and doing your thing to see friends like that go. I didn't really know all of them personally. I knew a couple of them, but that sort of set you back. And I recall at that time there was sort of a nervousness going through the flight training command, and everybody's looking at each other and said, well, maybe we should call Christmas leave a little bit early and get the hell out of here. But the Navy wasn't doing any of that. In the Navy, that was part of the training, so we didn't. And that was sort of an initial exposure to me of the risk level that was involved in flying. Of course, it was training, new people, and it was sort of in missions that were dangerous, like air-to-air rendezvous and things like that. And we had to put that all into the equation. But then later on in my career, several other real close friends that I lost. And I know what you're saying, and there were times that I had some close calls, too, where I thought, well, if it wasn't for Lord and the luck, I wouldn't be here today to do it. And I had a number of those, as you'd expect, through the flying. There are a number of fine aviators that I flew with and everything, that retired and everything, and maybe didn't even make their retirement life too long, had strokes and other things like that that sort of make you wonder about life. So I thank the Lord every day for my health and for what I had in my career and what things I've got through and made it through and everything. And you made a point. There was no reason why I couldn't have been one of those others that didn't make it, but for whatever reason, I did.
Well, and one follow-up on that, too, because on this show, you know, I'm usually talking to guys who served in World War II, and so often, you know, they'll talk about men they served with who passed, and there are over 400,000 who died in World War II, and more than 50,000 in the Korean War, and almost 60,000 in Vietnam, and we know what's happened in the wars since. And it's so easy for us to see that as the price of our freedom. For you and these other test pilots who died in the line of their duty, what's the significance of their sacrifice?
Well, I think it's the same as you'd look at a soldier who gave his life to protect his country. I think you'd look at the fact that the test pilot was doing his best to protect or advance his country and lost his life doing it. So I'd look at it at the same level.
Amen. And, you know, I always end this program with four words that mean a whole lot if you take the time to let them sink in. I always remind our listeners that freedom is not free. And we can say the same about advances in aviation and space exploration. There is a human cost associated with it, which should have something to do with the value we assign to it. We're about out of time, but Cameron, I want to give you the chance to share any closing thoughts.
If you wouldn't mind, Paul, I wouldn't mind closing. Don, this is one of the last things Don said in the documentary. It's taken from a Robert Frost poem, and Don read it so eloquently that really Don and I both discussed using it. It's just one verse of the poem called The Road Not Taken, and Don agreed 100% that it kind of really encapsulated his life, his career, and just kind of everything that he's kind of reiterated in this conversation. And if you don't mind, I can read just, it's the last verse from the film that Don read. Okay, it's called The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Wish Don could be reading this, but here we go. I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings a tear to my eye every time. even just reading this now and then seeing Don read that, telling about his career. So I'd like to close with that.
What a perfect way to wrap up our time today. Cameron Mitchell, Don Malik, thank you so much. Learn more about the documentary project they just finished at hometownheroesradio.com. That will link you to the trailer and lots of relevant information. Thanks for spending this hour with us today on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.